push a button, explained one case officer. His message went to the case officer's machine, which received the information and sent a message back automatically. Polyakov looked at Buster and saw a red light flashing that indicated the transmission was successful. Then he returned to his apartment and read our message. In a primitive form, Buster possibly represented the world's first text message exchanges. Buster was a technical leap in covert communications, equivalent to the telephone in public communications. The distance protected the identity of the communicators, while the short burst and encryption protected the communication itself. The major drawback was possession of the Schrack device, which would conclusively identify the owner as a spy. The cost of Buster's development required expenditures exceeding what OTS alone could afford. To cover the budgetary burden of such projects, OTS teamed up with other offices in the Directorate of Science and Technology, most often the Office of Development and Engineering and the Office of Research and Development. Many of ORD's original scientists who had been part of TSS and TSD now focused on long-term research programs and technology with potential value to the agency. OD&E engineers were responsible for satellite and overhead programs and the myriad technologies associated with their platforms, cameras, and sensors. The consulting role OTS played with ORD and OD&E was not an entirely new function. George Sachs had performed a similar task a few years earlier, translating DDP operational requirements for technology to OTS engineers. Now, the OTS engineers were supplying operational requirements to scientists in ORD and OD&E, merging new technology with the stringent operational requirements of denied areas. Just as a low-tech dead drop disguised as a brick had to come as close as possible to looking, feeling, and weighing the same as a real brick, similar types of pragmatic, operational design features had to be integrated into this new generation of high-tech devices. Whatever came out of the lab needed to be practical for an agent whose life could not be risked. It had to be easy and uncomplicated to use, even under enormous stress. These requirements were both obvious and not so obvious. For instance, Buster had to be small enough to conceal while transmitting. Two buttons to send a message was one too many, because the device had to be activated covertly with one hand inside a coat pocket. Its short-range line-of-sight transmission would need to be the equivalent of a whisper rather than a shout, since weaker transmissions were more difficult for counterintelligence receivers to detect. Powering the device presented unanticipated problems. With commercial batteries frequently in short supply in Moscow, Buster's batteries could be either rechargeable or resupplied via dead drop. The decision was made to go with rechargeable batteries, since every operational act, including loading and clearing a dead drop, was inherently risky. However, this meant the agent would need a battery charger and a way of concealing yet another piece of spy equipment at his home or office. OTS provided the concealment for Polyakov's Buster inside a stereo unit he purchased and shipped home before returning to Moscow in 1977. Other concealments were provided when he was outside the Soviet bloc, together with spare Busters. To attract less attention, these concealments were often designed to fit inside existing objects the agent already owned. There were logistical as well as operational challenges in Moscow to be solved. From what locations could the agent make a transmission without attracting suspicion? The TOOs ran covert signal path surveys to identify specific spots around the city suitable for transmissions and evaluated apartments as possible base stations. In order not to attract KGB attention while conducting these surveys, the casing work was divided among all the office personnel, who, with their concealed cameras, would covertly photograph the streets and the views outside the apartments to identify potential send and receive locations. The TOO processed the film from casing runs, and these street-level pictures were mated with headquarters-supplied overhead photography. The distances, angles, and interfering structures between the potential base stations and an agent's send positions were then plotted. As usable sites were identified, a site sketch map was prepared and passed to the agent via dead drop with the instructions, "Here are the places to go to make your transmission during the next time period." From the vantage point of the 21st century, Buster is a primitive technology. However, compared to technical spy gear available to Penkovsky, it was a miracle advance. Not only did it link the agent and case officer more closely in real time than ever before possible, it also provided anonymity and security for the agent. Within little more than a decade after Penkovsky's arrest, covert communications advanced from a matchbox dangling behind a radiator to electronic messaging that was virtually impossible to detect. Buster was not only created for Polyakov, but also benefited from his suggestions regarding its design and functionality. "In my opinion, Polyakov drove the technology," said one of his case officers. He would kind of teasingly say, "You mean to tell me the best you can do is give me something this big?" Sometimes I think he would do it for the fun of it, his way of letting the case officer know they had more of an equal relationship than agent-handler. Not everyone gets to be a general in the GRU, and he knew he was very good at his job. Plus, he had succeeded in working for us for years while leading a double life. Polyakov's input proved invaluable, despite his teasing remarks. He understood the Soviet counterintelligence capabilities at home and abroad, as well as the consequences he faced should the device or its use be discovered. When he finally received the finished version of Buster, he told his case officer, "Tell your technical people this is great. I love this piece of equipment." In 1980, Polyakov retired to pursue his passions for fishing, hunting, and woodworking. The story should have ended there, with a man of conscience quietly living out his remaining years. The KGB eventually discovered Polyakov's clandestine activities, but as with Trigon, the discovery did not come from any known deficiencies in technical equipment or tradecraft. Both were betrayed by Americans working for Soviet intelligence. Two Americans compromised Top Hat's identity. The first, FBI Special Agent Robert Hansen, exposed Polyakov to the GRU in 1979 while serving as a counterintelligence officer stationed in New York. The revelation strained credibility within the GRU and was thought to be almost unbelievable. By then, Polyakov was a respected senior officer, and even the somewhat timid proposal to launch a full investigation was turned down. Within the ranks of Soviet military intelligence, casting the shadow of suspicion on a lieutenant general was to gamble one's own career if the charge proved false, and few within the GRU were prepared to take that risk. But in May 1985, CIA officer Aldrich Ames provided information to the KGB that implicated General Polyakov as a CIA asset. As part of its ensuing investigation, the KGB lured Polyakov away from his modest dacha outside Moscow, then arrested, interrogated, and executed him in 1986. Reliable accounts relate that during his interrogation, he revealed details of what he handed over to his American contacts, and that he had refused the opportunity for exfiltration. In 1990, Pravda announced Polyakov's execution in a story detailing the account of a Soviet citizen who spied for the Americans named Donald. Donald, one of Polyakov's code names used in personal ads in the New York Times years earlier, was the type of detail revealed only during a detailed confession. By publicizing the story, the Soviets intended to send a message to the CIA and FBI, as well as to members of Soviet intelligence who might consider following Polyakov's path. From another perspective, the Soviet account confirmed Polyakov's status as, in the words of a case officer, "the most perfect agent one can reasonably imagine." Adolf Tolkachev waited patiently on a snowy street near a Moscow gas station in January 1977. The station was frequented by foreigners, and when an American-appearing driver stopped, Tolkachev asked in English if he was from the United States. When the driver answered that he was, Tolkachev calmly dropped a folded sheet of paper on the car seat through the open window. Since neither individual looked like what they were, it's difficult to say which of them would have been more surprised to learn the truth. Tolkachev, a middle-aged, undistinguished Russian, was actually a top Soviet military engineer who had recently decided to become a spy. The young, casually dressed American in the car was the local CIA chief. Both were carrying their own secrets and wary of the KGB watchers. Tolkachev, then a systems engineer in the NIIR, Scientific Research Institute of Radio, building, was, by his own description, a dissident at heart. Inspired by writers like Solzhenitsyn and Sakharov, he was in a state of near anguish. In one of his letters about his decision to spy, he wrote, "Some inner worm started to torment me. Something has to be done. I started to write short leaflets that I planned to mail out, but later, having thought it out properly, I understood that this was a useless undertaking. To establish contact with dissident circles which have contact with foreign journalists seemed senseless to me due to the nature of my work. I have top-secret clearance. Based on the slightest suspicion, I would be totally isolated or liquidated. Thus was born my plan of action to which I have resorted." Startled by the brief encounter, the chief read the note, which asked for a meeting with an appropriate American official for a confidential discussion and suggested a choice of discreet meeting places in either the car of the American or a metro station entrance. It proposed a response signal to confirm the meeting involving a car parked at a specific location. The envelope contained precisely drawn sketches of the locations, along with a diagram showing how the car should be parked to send the correct signal. Tolkachev could hardly have picked a worse time for the contact. Although a few operations, like Trigon, within Moscow were progressing, there remained a deep suspicion within the CIA of any Russian volunteer, especially in Moscow. That chance had brought the agency's Moscow chief face-to-face with Tolkachev on the initial contact attempt only amplified this distrust. What were the odds that a legitimate volunteer would hand a note to the highest-ranking American intelligence officer in Moscow? And the fact that Tolkachev's approach should occur just before a scheduled diplomatic visit by Cyrus Vance on behalf of a newly elected president, Jimmy Carter, made it all the more suspicious. On the other hand, many of the agency's most important agents, including Penkovsky, had volunteered in a similar manner. Penkovsky, for instance, had sent several messages in 1960 to two American students, a British businessman and a Canadian businessman, in an effort to establish a communications channel before the British followed up. However, if Tolkachev was a KGB dangle, responding to his approach could allow the Soviets to pinpoint agency personnel, identify agent-handling tradecraft, disrupt ongoing Moscow operations, and embarrass a newly elected president. Added to this was the fact that Tolkachev's notes failed to provide sufficient personal information to identify him or specifics about his access to information that might justify the risk in making contact. CIA headquarters directed its Moscow officers not to respond to the note. A month later, Tolkachev was back. This time he slid into the chief's car as it was parked. The two had a brief conversation, and Tolkachev left another note. Headquarters again directed that no response be made. 2 weeks later, Tolkachev returned a third time, leaving a note that provided additional personal and professional information. Headquarters considered the proposal again, but determined that counterintelligence concerns overrode any meeting. Then, in May, Tolkachev made a fourth approach, spotting the car and pounding on it to get the Americans' attention. He was ignored, and that summer the CIA chief left Moscow for another assignment. 6 months passed until December 1977, when an Italian national working for the Americans was approached by an unknown Soviet and handed a note at a local grocery store. In this note, Tolkachev volunteered to work as an agent, and included 2 pages of technical data on Soviet aircraft electronic systems to establish his access to sensitive information. Langley continued to forbid contact. There were now even more reasons to be cautious than before. A few months earlier, in August of 1977, barely a month after the arrest of Martha Peterson and loss of Trigon, a fire in the embassy, which some claimed was suspicious, destroyed 3 upper floors, including the roof. And other operations were compromised that autumn. The fire had been a physical disaster for much of the embassy. Ron Duncan, a TOO, was having an evening drink at the bar in the Marine House when reports arrived about smoke in the embassy. A few moments later, a Marine cadre discovered the fire already burning out of control on the upper floors. As calls went to the Moscow Fire Department, Ron rushed to his post and, with water from fire hoses pouring through the ceiling, acted as a guard throughout the night to prevent documents and equipment from being taken by the Russian firemen swarming through the building. The Russian firemen, I have to commend them, they were super. They were superb firefighters, said Ron. The Russians came in with a lot of fire trucks. They poured water on the fire from 10 o'clock Friday night until 8 Saturday morning. And I swear they were so efficient with their aim that not one drop of water hit the sidewalk. It was all concentrated on the fire in the building. But the combination of fire, water, and smoke wiped out several offices. Almost everything was destroyed. The fire presented a myriad of security problems. Damaged documents and photographs could not be thrown into the trash, which would likely be searched by the KGB. Nor, for the same reason, could the damaged furniture or office equipment be hauled to the Moscow dump. Security required that chairs, desks, typewriters, and other furnishings not locally procured had to be returned to the United States. A simple thing, such as the number of discarded chairs, might provide KGB's counterintelligence with an estimate of the number of agency personnel. It would, Ron knew, be a massive cleanup and reconstruction project. Virtually every piece of office furnishings was damaged beyond use and would have to be disassembled for shipment. The restoration work would go on 7 days a week, 18 hours a day, for more than a year. So Ron Duncan found himself with a third full-time job, ODA, Other Duties as Assigned. Cleaning up, disassembling, packing, shipping, and reconstruction occurred alongside his cover work and his TOO responsibilities of building concealments and deploying technology. At least I had some training, Ron recalled. My tech skills, electrical, painting, carpentry, all came in handy. Tolkachev, unaware of the disruptions caused by the fire, persisted in attempting to secure a meeting with an agency officer. It was not until February of 1978 that headquarters finally approved contact with the determined volunteer. Information on Soviet aircraft that he passed in his earlier note was found to be of such high value that the potential benefit was judged to outweigh the risks. In his previous letter, Tolkachev had included a partial telephone number missing 2 digits. His instructions informed the CIA he would be standing in line at a designated bus stop at a certain time holding 2 pieces of plywood, each with 1 of the missing digits written on it. All the CIA officer had to do was drive by the bus stop at the designated time and copy the missing digits. The plan failed. An attempt to dial the completed number proved unsuccessful. However, if agency personnel had any concerns that Tolkachev had given up, they were unfounded. The would-be agent was nothing if not dogged. As the chief was walking with his wife in March, Tolkachev unexpectedly approached and quickly handed over a package with 11 handwritten pages on airfield technology. Included in the package was detailed personal information regarding both himself and his family, along with an address, phone number, and other pertinent information. A case officer called the telephone number specified in the note, and this time made contact. If he was not a dangle, Tolkachev had taken an enormous risk in identifying himself and family while passing secret military information. Had that note fallen into the hands of the KGB, The consequences would have been dire. 5 months after the initial phone call, Tolkachev was directed to a Moscow dead-drop site near his home. Ron had constructed a concealment using a locally obtained construction worker's mitten. To give the appearance of an unusably dirty, well-worn mitten, he ripped and dirtied the glove so that it resembled a piece of litter. Dropped beside a phone booth near the would-be spy's apartment, it would attract no attention. Tolkachev could find concealed within the worn fabric all the materials needed to begin his clandestine reporting. The concealment contained special carbon paper for secret writing, 3 cover letters with non-alerting content whose blank reverse side would hold the SW message, accommodation addresses, a one-time pad to encipher and decipher exchanges, instructions for using the OTP, intelligence requirements, and operational instructions. A month later, 3 SW letters arrived at accommodation addresses outside the USSR. Once developed by OTS techs, their physical and chemical analysis revealed all 3 had been opened, but none showed signs that the SW was detected. The letters contained tantalizing information from Tolkachev, including the assertion that he had 91 pages of handwritten notes on subjects such as the new Soviet airborne radar and reconnaissance system and the status of a new Soviet aircraft weapons system. Soviet specialists judged the information to be so important that, despite the Trigon roll-up, Langley authorized a high-risk personal meeting to establish an in-country communications plan between Tolkachev and his handler. The meeting was scheduled for New Year's Day 1979. Because it was a popular holiday, KGB surveillance tended to be light. A Moscow case officer, after determining he was black, that is, without KGB surveillance, called Tolkachev at his apartment to trigger the meeting at a predetermined location. They talked while walking outside in the frigid Moscow winter for less than an hour. Tolkachev passed nearly 100 pages of highly technical aeronautical design data that included diagrams, electronic specifications, and material copied from official papers. In return, the case officer gave him a list of intelligence requirements along with good faith money. The case officer reported that Tolkachev was calm, deliberate, and one of the few Russians sober on such a major holiday. In Washington, Pentagon and agency analysts marveled at the detail of the intelligence passed along at the meeting. The reporting was consistent with other verified information about Soviet aircraft technology and expanded the U.S. understanding of Soviet efforts in weapons systems design. 7 months before that first personal meeting with Tolkachev, samples of his initial letters and notes were studied by an OTS handwriting analyst. The graphologist, who received no identifying information about Tolkachev, not even his nationality or background on the case, returned a report that concluded, "The writer is intelligent, purposeful, and generally self-confident. He is self-disciplined, but not overly rigid. He has well-above-average intelligence and has good organizing ability. He is observant and conscientious and pays meticulous attention to details. He is quite self-assured and may plow ahead at times in a way which is not discreet or subtle. All in all, he is a reasonably well-adjusted individual and appears intellectually and psychologically equipped to become a useful, versatile asset." A year later, Tolkachev would describe his motivation. "I have chosen a course which does not permit one to move backward, and I have no intention of veering from this course. My actions in the future depend on my health and changes in the nature of my work. Concerning remuneration, I would not begin to establish contact for any sum of money with, for example, the Chinese embassy. But how about America? Maybe it has bewitched me, and I am madly in love with it. I have not seen your country with my own eyes, and to love it unseen, I do not have enough fantasy or romanticism. However, based on some facts, I got the impression that I would prefer to live in America. It is for this very reason that I decided to offer you my collaboration. But I am not an altruist alone. Remuneration for me is not just money. It is, even to a greater extent, The Evaluation of the Significance and the Importance of My Work. Tolkachev had studied optomechanical radar training, graduating from the Kharkov Polytechnical Institute in 1954. He worked as a leading systems designer in a large open office with 24 other people. Earning 250 rubles a month, plus a 40% secrecy bonus, he lived with his wife and son in a ninth-floor apartment consisting of two rooms, plus a kitchen, bath, and toilet. Though above average for the typical Soviet, the cramped quarters would later complicate his clandestine work. Following the first personal meeting in January 1979, the CIA realized that Tolkachev, in contrast to Polyakov and Penkovsky, had no familiarity with basic tradecraft, such as dead drops or counter-surveillance. His job and personal status precluded any secure way to provide the kind of training Trigon had received outside the USSR. Under those circumstances, the decision was made to continue personal meetings in Moscow as the primary means for communicating. For the next 18 months, Tolkachev was safely met every 2 or 3 months. During those meetings, Tolkachev passed information while the case officer refined operational details of the elaborate communication system customized to accommodate the agent's circumstances at work and home. Every 3 months, Tolkachev was given the opportunity to pass material to his handler via a dead drop. If the dead drop was to be used, there was a ready-to-receive signal left at a prearranged public site. The signal would have been as simple as a lipstick mark on a telephone pole or a colored thumbtack left on a wooden signpost, invisible to anyone who might pass by. Once the package had been received, the next day the case officer put up a recovery signal confirming that the dead drop had been cleared. Tolkachev could also initiate a dead drop any Monday by making a mark at a predetermined location. The case officer would reply that he was ready to recover the following Wednesday by using a parked car signal. The same night Tolkachev saw the signal, he would fill the dead drop. Despite the greater safety of dead drops, Tolkachev preferred personal meetings and argued they were no more risky than dead drops, since the case officer had to be free of surveillance to either make the meet or clear the drop. His handlers acquiesced, in part because new OTS technologies had greatly improved the CIA's surveillance detection tools. Tolkachev had access to an unprecedented array of technical documents, but lacked a way to copy them. A film-based, easily concealed camera was the best solution available. The Minox Model 3 had functioned well for Penkovsky 20 years earlier, but was best suited for copying documents in a studio or office where the user could work free from worries about security. Except for their size, these commercial sub-miniature cameras were not designed for covert use. With their noisy shutters, no automatic film advance, and lack of capability to discreetly photograph a document, the commercial products did not make good spy cameras for high-risk operations. What Tolkachev needed was a camera that could be concealed and operated while seated at his desk, like the one used by Trigon. Unfortunately, for an untested and untrained agent, the agency did not want to risk the technology. OTS came up with an alternative, constructing a small, concealable camera and light meter, which was passed to Tolkachev via a dead drop glove in February of 1979. While the camera had worked perfectly in the OTS laboratory, Tolkachev identified a number of operational limitations. The slow film speed, although faster than the original, commercially available Minox film, required more light than was readily available inside his office. The click noise of the shutter also caused him to worry about attracting unwanted attention. He found it awkward and impractical to hold the camera steady for the required exposure time. Of more than a dozen rolls of film that Tolkachev passed to case officers in April and June of 1979, most of the images turned out to be blurred and unreadable. At Tolkachev's suggestion, until a better camera could be provided, he was given a Pentax ME 35mm SLR with a commercial copy clamp that could be affixed to the back of a chair to hold the camera steady over the document. The arrangement produced excellent images. but was suited for use only when he could find a few moments of privacy in his apartment. Even given these restrictions, the camera didn't dampen his enthusiasm or slow production. In October and December of 1979, he passed 150